Hello!
Welcome to Should I Love This Comic? My name is Damien Drewe-Whiter.
And my name is Irigail Drewe-Whiter.
And we're here today with our Halloween Spooktacular.
We promise to stop doing that.
Maybe. Today we're going to be looking at Dazzler number 33. It has a cover date of August 1984 and it was on sale on the 24th of April 1984. It's written by Mike Carlin, penciled by M.D. Bright, credited as Mark Bright. It's inked by Vince Coletta, he's credited as Vinnie Coletta. Lettered by Jack Morelli and coloured by Andy Yankus. It's an unusual surname. The cover art's by Bill Sienkiewicz. So today we're going to be talking about the unusual history of Dazzler. Dazzler is one of the most bizarre creations of the Marvel 1980s. She was created at the instigation of Marvel Vice President of Business Affairs, Alice Donenfeld. That's an exciting title, isn't it? You could tell she was a great writer from that title. She had the idea of creating a Saturday morning cartoon band along the line of the Archies, thinking she could find a record company and a Hollywood studio to work with. The project was given to writer Tom DeFalco and artist John Romita Jr. to develop. John Romita Jr. was in his early 20s at the time and was really into the New York club scene. His initial sketches for the character used Grace Jones as a reference. This is part of the reason I've always wanted to do Dazzler on this book, because we're big Grace Jones fans, and you in particular.
We are.
Yes, we do have a wall of Grace Jones in our house.
We do.
And Grace Jones on the non-Grace Jones wall as well, because why not?
Yes,
she shares that with lots of other things as well, including a bit of Bobby Gentry and some Adam Hughes original art for the comics fans. So as part of Alice Donenfeld's campaign to create a Saturday morning cartoon based on Dazzler, Neil Bogart, who was the founder of Casablanca Records, met with our podcast protagonist, Jim Shooter. We're used to him.
We are.
About creating a treatment for a cartoon series that would use Casablanca's roster in voice roles. And their roster at the time, the people who wanted to give voice roles in this cartoon, were Grace Jones.
Hey.
Cher.
Hey.
Donna Summer.
Woo.
The Village People.
Yeah.
And Kiss.
I've got no sound for Kiss.
Yeah, Kiss have never been as big in the UK as they are in America.
No.
It's something that doesn't really make much sense to us. Particularly, in my sense, the fact that there were loads and loads of Kiss comics over the years has really never made any sense to me. Anyway, Jim Shooter wrote the treatment in a few days, which Bogart decided was so good he wanted to make a live-action feature film instead of a Saturday morning cartoon. So this is where Dazzler is first put. This character that was developed by John Romita Jr. and Tom DeFalco was going to be in this film treatment that Jim Shooter wrote. Around this time, Casablanca Records started experiencing financial difficulties, and it became clear that they wouldn't be able to fund a movie. At this point, Alice Donenfeld began shipping it around and got Bo Derek interested, finally signing a contract at the 1980 Cannes Film Festival. The chance of signing Bo Derek led to John Romita Jr.'s original character design being changed to a white woman with blonde hair. So originally she was going to look more like Grace Jones, and he redesigned her as a white woman with blonde hair. This is how Dazzler, also known as Alison Blair, debuted in Uncanny X-Men 130, which had a cover date of February 1980, but was released on the 20th of November 1979. So almost a Halloween release. She only just missed out. A year later, from March 81, with a release date of the 2nd of December 1980, Dazzler number 1 debuted. It was the first Marvel comic released exclusively to comic shops and not released to newsstands. By this time, Bo Derek was insisting that her husband, John Derek, had to be the director. He was famous at the time for films that broke their budgets, and as soon as he was involved, many of the backers began to drop out. Apparently Marvel continued to try and get the film made, but it eventually failed. Marvel did get a moderately successful series out of Dazzler, though. It ran for 42 issues from 1980 to 1985, and then the character moved over to Uncanny X-Men, where she was a member of the team from issues 214 to 260. Since then, she has continued to make occasional appearances throughout the X-Men books and is a regular character in the line to the day. So we've got this character created for a cartoon or movie or to sell records. It was meant to be like this link-up character.
Mm.
That never happened, but we still got the character. Mm. You know, you get characters out of all weird kind of ways.
Mm.
People create characters sometimes hoping that they'll be spun off into their own series, and then they're not, and then vice versa. They create a character just to be a background person, and someone else takes them on and makes them a big star.
Mm.
So that's how Dazzler got her start. At this point, we're looking at Dazzler number 33. And it's a Halloween special because it's called
Chiller. Whoa.
And it's about shooting a music video for a song by the pop star Teddy Lingard. Yes. He's looking at the cover of Dazzler the movie next to me at the moment.
Okay.
Which was not an actual movie. It was a graphic novel.
Oh, was it?
Starring Dazzler. Which came out about 2 months after the issue that we're looking at. So this is very much the lead-in, and I think that's part of the reason it's a guest issue. So as I said, it's not by the regular creative team on Dazzler, which was Frank Springer mainly, sometimes writing or co-writing with Jim Shooter. And it was always inked by Vince Coletta, who did ink it. But this is a fill-in, probably while they were working on getting it ready. So it's Dazzler number 33, Chiller, set on a video shoot for a horror-themed pop song.
Mm.
It's close to midnight. Something evil's lurking in the dark. Under the moonlight, you see a sight that almost stops your heart. You try to scream, but terror takes the sound before you make it. And you start to freeze, and so it looks you right between the eyes. You're paralyzed. You hear the door slam and realize there's nowhere left to run. You feel the cold hand and wonder if you ever see the sun. You close your eyes and hope that this is just imagination.
Alison Blair has gone to see Bob Benson's latest film, Bloody Mary, with her friend Janet. Alison doesn't really like horror movies, so decides to leave. She is thankful for the light powers she possesses as Dazzler as she lights her way out of the darkened movie theatre. Janet follows Ali out. As they walk away, they're so spooked that they almost walk into traffic. Once she calms down, Ali makes her way home, where she receives a call from her agent, Roman Neckerbar, inviting her to a Hollywood party. At the party, Roman tries to keep Ali away from sketchy characters, but eventually she ends up chatting to director Bob Benson. She tells him that she saw his movie, but when he questions her about the twist ending, she has to admit that she didn't make it to the end. Bob laughs and asks Ali to appear in a video he's directing for Teddy Lingard. Ali goes to tell Roman about the job, but he is concerned. Bob Benson is known for lack of safety on his sets, and he doesn't want anything to happen to Alison. Just then, the party is rocked by an explosion outside. Someone has set fire to Bob Benson's car. Alison hears a noise coming from the bushes. She uses her light powers to find Benson lying on the ground. Ali manages to get him to safety before the car explodes again. Roman offers him a lift to the hospital, but he just wants to go home. The next day, Ali reads about the explosion in the paper and worries about the risk of working with Bob Benson. After teaching her exercise class, Alison phones Benson, who invites her to an audition. Bob offers her a job without really checking her dance ability, and asks her back the following day. After 2 hours in the makeup chair, Ali looks like a zombie. Her and the other zombies enjoy joking about their makeovers, but they soon take the time to learn the dance routine. Eventually, pop star Teddy Lingard arrives and everyone gets a break before filming. Alison needs the bathroom, so she walks past Bob Benson phoning a news crew to tell them there's been a tragedy on the video set. Ali and all the other zombies are buried alive so they can shoot them rising from the grave. When it comes to the scene, Ali is the only one who doesn't climb out. Benson shouts that she has no air hose. Ali is able to escape the grave and grab Benson by the ankle. She rises up saying,
"Bob Benson, you're to blame!"
Benson runs away but admits in front of the cameras that he wanted her to die and rigged the accidents on his previous movies for publicity. When Benson realises Ali isn't a real zombie, he tries to run away, but he is tripped by Teddy Lingard doing one of his signature dance moves. As Ali goes to ring Roman, Teddy considers getting the guy who directed An American Werewolf in London to finish the video.
Darkness falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell.
That was fun, wasn't it?
It was.
It's actually quite a fun story, and for a Halloween-themed one, actually, not that scary, I suppose.
No.
Maybe, I suppose you could be fearful for Alison at the point when she's buried alive.
Yes.
But I think, you know, she's the title character of the book.
Yes.
I think people knew she was coming back.
She wasn't gonna, yeah.
She wasn't going to die. Should we start talking through the ways that we normally talk about comics?
Yeah.
So we have a list of five things, if this is your first time listening.
We do.
That we talk about. We talk about accessibility, mm-hmm. artwork, characterization, mm-hmm. and the cover. Mm-hmm. And then we possibly take off points under a section we often call acceptable in the 80s. We haven't been doing the scoring. Since we've been doing the scoring, we haven't done any comics that come outside of the 80s.
No.
So I suppose this would be, you know, depictions stuck in its time kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, things that aren't appropriate anymore. Shall we start with accessibility?
Yes.
Now, I gave accessibility a 5, and you gave accessibility a 5. Uh-huh. So I feel it, well, your feeling was it's very readable.
My feeling is it's very readable. You know who the characters are.
It's very clear, isn't it? You know what's happening.
You know who
the
people
art,
are.
You can tell what's going on. It's simple in some ways.
Yeah.
Which makes it very easy to access.
To read.
You know, you come in as a new person, you get it. You have to understand that there's film directors and there's music videos.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to get the quite obvious analogies, shall we say analogies? References to real life people.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, the whole story is a reference to John Landis, the director.
Landon, isn't it?
Landis.
Is it? Okay.
You're thinking of Michael Landon, who was an actor.
Who was it?
Was he one of Starsky and Hutch?
Stairway to Heaven.
He was in Stairway to Heaven, wasn't he? That is an important.
Which I had a little bit of a crush on.
Yes, this is really working, isn't it? As a sensible, calm discussion of a comic where we just sit here and talk about Michael Landon. No, John Landis was a film director, quite really famous. He did An American Werewolf in London, which is actually a reference.
Uh-huh.
And he was part of a film called Twilight Zone in the early 80s, okay. Which was it was like an anthology film. So it was only Steven Spielberg.
Oh, of course.
Him and someone else's name I can't remember. And they were all doing a section.
We've watched some of them, haven't we?
No, I don't think it got released.
Oh, okay.
I could be wrong, but I don't think they ever released it. Okay. We will check into this and let you know. Possibly, if I remember. No, he did this and his was like a war bit.
Right.
It was set during the Vietnam War, and he was recording this thing, and a helicopter crashed, And the accusations after the fact were that he kept trying to get the helicopter to go lower and lower. So the fact that it got damaged and then crashed, and it actually apparently decapitated one of the main actors and one of the child actors.
Oopsie.
And the other person who died was another child actor who just got crushed. They didn't get decapitated. But, you know, really gruesome and awful accident on a film set. And, you know, people have different opinions to it. He was cleared in court, but then he's an exceptionally rich man. And we know that often in civil cases, he had to give lots of money to the families.
Not the decapitated people.
Yeah, the families of the decapitated, which doesn't really help, does it? You know, money doesn't replace your head. Oh, sorry. That was really bad taste joke, wasn't it? It is a Halloween episode. We can talk in bad taste. He was cleared of any legal culpability from, like, a criminal point of view. But the story is he was responsible and he was making people behave in ways that weren't right. You know, and he did get done for things like working child actors too long without breaks. There were all kinds of health and safety violations. Okay. So obviously they're referencing with Bob Benson, this character. So then at the very end, they kind of turn it by the Teddy Lingard character going, well, maybe I could get the guy who directed An American Werewolf in London. So this is obviously not the guy, which feels to me almost like it was put in by Marvel's, like, lawyer department. But actually, it probably was just
a joke.
Well, and I think the...
funny.
Yeah, I think the writer, Mike Carlin, was an editor as well. Mm. The editor, Ralph Macchio, obviously an editor. I think that both of them would have known well enough that you can't directly put a person in there without being sued.
No.
It has to be clear that it's not that person.
They come very close to it, though.
But yeah, it's very clearly that character.
I mean.
And also, obviously, the Teddy Lingard character is Michael Jackson. And the video shoot is the Thriller video.
Clearly.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's dancing zombies. There are scenes of the dancers dancing that look like the dancing in the video. And we did check. I checked earlier when we were talking about it after you read it, but before we recorded. Mm. And I went and looked because I thought, well, they must have seen the Thriller video. And this comic was released like 4 months after, 4.5 months after the premiere of the video. Mm. So that's more than enough time for them to have seen the video. That it was based on the real thing. It helps if you know that, but you don't need to know that. Mm. In some ways, it's funnier, it's more interesting if you know the real life relatability. You know, it is quite satisfying. I mean, for me, when the stuff I've read about John Landis, I kind of, on a personal level, feel like he's got away with things that he shouldn't have got away with very easily. And it's quite nice to see him kind of getting arrested by the police book.
So has he done dubious things since?
He's continued to have a reputation for not being a very nice person and not treating actors well. Not necessarily. I think there's this worry that when you do this thing where the director is the auteur, he's God, he's the one who makes the whole thing, you give them the power to do things that are not a good idea. You know, you haven't got an equal workplace. And I mean, there's no talk about him doing anything, like he hasn't been accused of sexually assaulting anyone. His son has, who is also a director and a writer. And in part, when he was caught doing that, he also wrote comics as well. But his son did in part blame it on growing up around people blaming his father for the death of people.
Okay.
Which is slightly disingenuous in my mind. But what do I know? What do I know? Yeah. I'm not an expert on...
No.
You know, I don't think your father having been accused of killing people on a film set is a good reason to sexually assault other people.
No.
Maybe that's just me. I don't know.
You're old-fashioned.
I am. I'm very old-fashioned in my morals. You know, no sexual assaults, no killing people on film sets.
Yeah.
You know, health and safety is quite important. I genuinely think that, you know...
At work.
Do you know what? Yeah. When you're at work, there's an element where it's just filling in forms because you have to.
Yes.
But I always try and think, you know, this is important. If something happens,
yes,
the people are more important than anything.
They are.
You know, whether it's your co-workers, whether it's yourself, whether it's, you know, in my case, I work in retail, it's customers. Whoever's around you, their safety is paramount. They're more important than the money. They're more important than time. There are, you know, you might have pressure of lots of things to do, but if you don't get the health and safety done.
I'm beginning to wonder if we've got an accident book at work now. Never mind.
Our accident book's digital now.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Last time I fell over, my mum said, did you put it in the accident book? I'm like, there hasn't been an accident book for about 10 years, mother. My mother's retired. Anyway, let's move on. So we were talking about accessibility. We both gave it 5 out of 5.
Uh-huh.
It's a very clear comic. It doesn't rely on you knowing lots of backstory about Dazzler.
Uh-huh.
You need to know that she's got superpowers, and that's it. And they show you those superpowers on, like, page 2.
Yeah.
You know, they really do introduce her. Her friend Janet, it doesn't really matter who she is. She's, like, a background character. Yeah. You get introduced to Roman, the film director. Mm. You get introduced to... Sorry, her agent. You get introduced very well to Bob Benson. You know he's a Hollywood type. And you get told about the things that have happened with health and safety. Mm. And then, you know who Teddy Lingard is. It's a very obvious character. So, yeah, I think 10 out of 10 for that is definitely reasonable.
Totally.
So we move on to artwork, and we disagreed here.
Did we?
Yes. You gave it 4 out of 5.
I did.
And I gave it 3 out of 5.
You did.
And the reason I gave it a lower score than you, I think, is because of Vince Coletta. And
poor Vince.
Yeah, poor Vince. He's been dead quite a while now. So
even poorer.
Yeah, yeah. He can only come and tell us off if he becomes a zombie, and then it's a real Halloween episode. Yeah. So Vince Coletta inks this. Now, comics fans, you're not a comics fan as such,
right?
You're finding out about comics through the podcast. That's part of our purpose.
Mm.
And comics fans know about Vince Coletta and have an opinion. And he's very, very famous for the fact that he would take shortcuts in his art.
Mm.
Now, there's two opinions on Vince Coletta. One of them is that he ruined people's art.
Okay.
Because he was famous for doing things, simplifying things. So he would erase background, he'd erase characters, mm-hmm. he'd use silhouettes instead of a drawing that an artist had done.
Mm-hmm.
This meant that he was the fastest inker in comics. Now, because he's the fastest inker in comic, he was often given jobs that were running late.
Right.
So he was doing that, rubbing out characters in the background and simplifying. He was doing that because the editors wanted him to ink 20 pages in like a weekend or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the kind of debate within fandom is, was that his fault? Was he a bad artist, or was that the company's fault? That they chose a bad artist because he would get it turned around in time, and they would get fined if a comic was late.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about that before, haven't we? You know, with fill-ins and using multiple inkers and stuff, that they sometimes they have to make up the time.
Yeah.
Now, what Vince Coletta was definitely good at doing was drawing women.
Okay.
And he got his start as a comics artist in the 50s. He drew romance comics.
Ah.
Completely by himself initially, and then he ended up being more of an inker than a penciler.
Mm.
And he was really well known for that. You know, he drew very beautiful women. But I think he rinses detail out of things, and he quite often will do quite generic faces.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the issue with this particular comic, which I wanted to show you an example. We're looking at this at Marvel Unlimited because
we can.
I don't have the actual comic on this one. I have the Marvel Essentials volume with it in, but that's in black and white. I think it's better to see it in colour. So let me find the page. I wanted to show you a couple of pages, just to tell you what I mean.
Okay.
So he was quite a good artist of drawing women, but what he would quite often do is he would take a character that was drawn in the style of the artist and then turn it into a Vince Coletta drawing. So, here on this page here, this is when she goes for the audition. So we're looking at, has it got a page number? Page 14 on Marvel Unlimited, so it'd be the 13th story page.
Okay.
Because the first page is the cover. And it's a, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 panel page. And this will be in our gallery post, which will be on our blogspot, which is shouldiloveThis.blogspot.com. And if you look at that page and how the faces look, Alison's face changes in the last panel.
Okay.
And in that last panel, she's drawn as a generic Vince Coletta woman. Okay. Whereas when Mark Bright, particularly the panel above, draws her, she's got a very different face shape.
Yeah, I see that, yeah.
Yeah, so Vince Coletta was known for drawing beautiful women. And sometimes he would, like, change things to make them what he drew. And I think in this story, what it does is it takes away the idiosyncrasy. I can't say that word. It takes away a lot of the interest of Mark Bright's art. He is an artist. His people look like people. You mentioned earlier that you like the crowd scenes. Before we were talking about it on here, Eric Gale said to me, I really like the crowd scenes when he was reading it. And Mark Bright was always very good at, I don't know why I'm talking about him in past tense, he still draws comics today, but getting realistic looking people. And it was like he looked at people and like the clothing and the expression and everyone's face is different. And that's quite rare for a new comics artist. This is only his seventh work. His seventh published comic is this one. And yet he's got these individual faces because he's a good artist. And I think Vince Coletta sometimes removes that. At times she stops being drawn by the penciler. And for me, that made me take a mark off. So I took it down to 3 instead of 4. It is a successful comic. And the layouts in particular, the way that the panels are laid out, the way the action moves, is very, very cinematic, very clear. You know what's going on.
It's also quite classic and also quite... romance comic-y.
Yeah, you can definitely see that. Right. I mean, in images, of particularly the way Alison's drawn. And obviously, you know, Vince Coletta was the regular inker on Dazzler because he was good at drawing beautiful women. And it was a book where the main character was a beautiful woman. And he was actually quite an effective inker for the penciler on that book, which normally was Frank Springer.
The one thing I thought...
Yeah.
Was that because, sort of like, and this kind of makes sense with your romance comics things, I didn't necessarily think it was very specifically 1983, the style or the fashion sense or whatever. I mean, I thought the men looked a bit like they were from the 1950s or...
Yeah, 60s. I think, I mean, some of that will be the Vince Coletta-ness. Some of that, I think, as well, is, you know, I've said I think Mark Bright draws quite good clothing. It looks like clothing. You know, sometimes some comics artists, it looks like lines are drawn on naked bodies. Even like your pedestrians in the background look like that. And it does look like clothing, but there's a very... It is true that, like many artists of the early 80s, it was quite normal for people to draw people... in quite generic clothing that didn't seem specified to the person. You know, your background characters would wear an open neck shirt or a t-shirt and they'd wear shorts or slacks. There was nothing else going on. I think Alison's clothes feel quite 80s.
Yeah.
And I think, like, the different workout outfits.
That's quite fun.
Yeah, and the little shorts and stuff.
With the...
Oh, where they can see the film in the background.
Yeah.
When they've walked out, and I think kind of Janet still wants to watch.
That's kind of unnecessary, but it's kind of...
Yeah, it shows effective. What's going on, yeah.
It's quite effective. And the crowd scenes that we were talking about.
Like, when they're at the party and in the movie theatre, the people look different. They look like a mix of people. And one thing I like as well about Mark Bright, and when I first found out more about Mark Bright, it made a lot more sense.
Mm.
He's a black guy, which at that time, not a lot of comics artists were black, okay. You know. And I think he particularly draws good black people.
Okay.
And you can tell that people have different kind of ethnic backgrounds within a crowd scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's very, very common to see a crowd scene in comics where everybody is just a generic wasp. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I think that adds something. And I think you lose some of that through the fact that, you know, Vince Coletta kind of evens everyone out, makes them all look pretty similar. So I think, you know, as I say, I think it looks fairly effective.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it would be better if it was inked by someone else.
Yeah.
The same pencils with a different inker would look better. And for me, I had to score that down to 3. So we're giving this 7 out of 10, which is still a pretty high score. You know, it's not a badly drawn comic. Should we talk about characterization?
Yes.
Can you remember what you told me your score was for characterization?
5, 4, 4.
Okay. And I gave it a 3.
Okay.
And my feeling was, as far as it comes to character, there are 2 characters in this comic. There's Dazzler and there's Bob Benson, and everyone else is just kind of in the periphery. They haven't really got characters. How did you feel?
I enjoyed the characterization. People had motives that you could understand. People had character.
I mean, yeah, maybe I'm being mean giving it a 3, but I just felt like, you know, the best writing, the best comic book writing and art, although I think it's there a bit in the art from Mark Bright, has, you know, some individuality to each character. There's something about their dialogue, there's something about them. You get this little peek within them to know who they are.
Mm.
And I don't think anyone's got an interior life apart from those 2 characters.
Mm.
Maybe argue Roman trying to protect her, but that's very top level. And literally the only people, actually I was about to say literally, I don't know if this is true, but I think the only people who had thought bubbles in the whole thing are Dazzler and Bob Benz and Teddy Lingard at the very end.
Okay.
When he's thinking about who he's going to give the film to.
Okay.
But nobody else seems to have any interior life. That was my feeling. So I gave it 3, you gave it 4, so that's 7 out of 10 again. But
then what I liked about the interior lives thing is that sometimes in some comics that we've done, people seem to be talking to themselves a lot without having kind of little sort of like,
without thought bubbles. They're saying out loud things that they would all already know, I suppose, is something that happened.
Yeah, or they're talking to themselves.
I mean, some of the characterization thing comes from this being, this is clearly a fill-in. It's written by an editor. He may have still been an assistant editor at this moment, but he was someone who was moving from one job to another. Mm-hmm. Someone who works in the offices. It's drawn by a new guy.
Mm-hmm.
It was obviously done as a fill-in. So they can't change the world. They can't create a new romance for Dazzler. Yeah. They can't, you know, they can't introduce a new character and give them lots of depth and lots of time on screen.
Yeah.
Because they're just doing a fill-in.
Yeah.
So I can see why you would keep characterization quite slight and just use the main character and the one-off character.
Mm.
Because you can't do that thing in a really great, some of my favourite comics are the ones where there's these big ensemble casts. And, you know, even solo books, like when we did the Spider-Man comics, you've got Robbie Robertson and you've got J. Jonah Jameson and you've got Joey Mercado and you've got all these other characters who are part of the story, and they all have an identity and they're all individual characters.
But I guess for those people,
but I suppose that can be really complicated.
Mm, but I guess for those people who dip in and out of comics, which may not have been the case back in when you were buying them.
Which, in fairness, was later than this.
By their droves.
Yeah.
But the that this is a one-off story, there's no prequel.
I mean, this would have been an absolutely amazing, sequel, like, newsstand comic. You know, if you just pick this up on a newsstand, never having bought it before, because of the cover, which will be the next thing we talk about, maybe you saw the cover and you were like, wow, what is that? Pick it up, take it home, read it. You get a complete story.
Yeah.
You know, one character may be enough to make you come back for another one. Yeah. And he's got quite a good, like, next one, isn't it? It's like something like what's happening to all the models in LA or something, isn't it? It's like really...
And they're all getting murdered.
Who's kidnapping the great models of LA?
Yeah.
You know, that's a great next column. I mean, that's like, well, what's happening there? I do want to read the next one.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, when I was going through these on Marvel Unlimited, refinding that, because I had read it before in my Essentials volume, but I wanted to see the colour version. And with Marvel Unlimited, it always takes you to the next issue. And I read on. I read a few more issues.
Oh, okay.
Because I was enjoying it. You know, it was fun. And I was like, oh, I like the character.
It's perfectly enjoyable.
Yeah. And I think she's an interesting character. Yeah. And it's an interesting kind of comic where it isn't about big supervillain versus...
No.
Villain, supervillain, superhero battles. You know, she's a hero, but on a very low level. Yeah. And the powers are used for very small things.
Yeah.
You know, it's not... it's not big.
She's not going to destroy a whole city.
No. I mean, she could. She's bad.
She could, but...
You know, but she doesn't. So we gave that one 7 out of 10. I think, basically, the difference in our scoring was about whether... I want it to be more complex and more characters and feel more ensemble, which maybe is a fault with me, not with the book. I don't know.
I like simple things.
Yeah. Well, we do like it simple. You did marry me, so you obviously like simple
things.
You
married me.
I'm not at all complex. Okay, so let's move on to the cover. Let's look at this amazing cover. Where is it? Let me bring it up on Marvel Unlimited. They're getting a lot of adverts from us today, aren't they?
We should get
points or something, you know.
We should get advert.
Yeah.
Your publicity.
I don't know how I keep losing it. So it's Dazzler in Chiller. With a very moody looking picture of Dazzler in a red jacket on the left, and then a painting of Dazzler looking like a zombie wearing the Michael Jackson jacket from the Thriller video with thigh-high leg warmers on.
Yeah.
Now, this is 80s.
Yeah.
This is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, the corner box always has a picture of the character.
Oh, okay.
So this is drawn by Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah.
Anyone who knows Bill Sienkiewicz's work or has heard us discuss the comics that he's been involved in that we've covered already, which he's only been an inker so far. Or a cover inker, will know that I'm giving this 5 out of 5. What about you, darling?
I'm giving it 5 out of 5.
I mean, it's absolutely breathtakingly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It is creepy and stunning, and it just grabs your attention. It's just almost unreal. He is a master artist. Particularly good at covers. He's very good at like that one arresting image that will just grab you.
Tells you what you need to know, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's clearly Thriller, but with Dazzler.
Mm.
You know, and it looks amazing.
And the little details,
like zooming in and having a look at bits, and I mean, it just looks breathtakingly beautiful. There we go. Let's look at it here. I've got it on the screen as well. It just...
The zip.
And the characters in the background.
The zip is good.
Yeah. Just everything. There's just so much going on. And, you know, you've got light reflecting off her fingernail paint. And I love the outfits the characters in the background are wearing.
Mm.
The guy to the left almost looks like he's at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party.
Mm.
It really is an absolutely amazing thing. It's a comic that will make you want to read it, I think, anyway. And that's what a good cover should do. It should make you want to read it.
It's interesting they're all people in suits.
Yeah, I think people are dressed quite smartly in the Thriller video. Have I made that up? Because you get buried in a suit, don't you? So zombies would be quite formally dressed.
Perfect. Yeah.
You know, zombies don't usually get buried. Well, people don't get buried in, like, their pyjamas. My dad was buried in his pyjamas, actually.
Was he?
Yeah. Yeah, Mum put him in his favourite pyjamas. Yeah. But, yeah, most people get buried in a suit or something, don't they? Or their best dress, or...
Seems a shame, really.
Yeah. I don't quite know.
I'll get buried naked.
Oh, you dirty thing.
Scare. Jesus.
There we go. So I gave it 5 out of 5. You gave it...
5 out of 5.
5 out of 5. So we're 10 out of 10 on that one. Mm. So that gives us a grand total so far of 34. And we come to the acceptable in the 80s, the things we have to take points off for.
We do.
And there was one that you read out to me as you were reading it, and I was like pottering around the room, so I think sorting out some washing or something, like a very glamorous person on a Sunday afternoon. And you actually mentioned one of the phrases of, ooh, that's a bit much. Can you remember what that was?
It's something about her boss said.
Yeah, her agent turns around to her on the phone and says, wear something sexy.
Yeah.
And instantly you know that's not acceptable anymore, and was acceptable in the 80s. You could possibly argue as well that...
I'm not even sure if it's acceptable in the 80s, I mean, if my...
No, but you got away with putting it in a comic on the 80s.
I mean, if my mother's ex-husband had said that to her.
Yes, I imagine that would have gone down badly.
That had gone down badly.
Yes, he might have been beheaded. Mm. That would have been a Halloween spectacular. Yeah, and like a lot of the concept of the comic you wouldn't do now. I don't think somebody would do a parody of a film director where they make them the villain nowadays. Mm. I just don't think that would happen.
Yeah.
I think there would be too... I think with Marvel being owned by Disney and the big conglomerateness and the link to the films, I think that kind of risk just wouldn't happen nowadays. It'd be too big a risk. And to be honest, whoever the equivalent would be of a John Landis nowadays, I know he still makes dust up, but he's an old man now. You know, the equivalent of him nowadays is probably somebody who's working for Marvel as a director, so they're not going to make a joke about it.
No.
But yeah, the whole thing feels... I think the wear something sexy really pulls it down.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of talk about her sexuality.
You are the...
You know, people like her look. She was chosen for her looks.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that going on, which just feels a little uncomfortable, looked at through a 21st century...
Very much so.
...lens. And... You know, you can excuse it on, well, a character might say that.
Mm, yeah.
You know, a manager of a pop star stroke actress in the 1980s probably would tell her to wear something sexy. Possibly they'd do that nowadays. I don't think it's character. I think it's just something that was put in the script without them even thinking about it.
Mm.
Just thinking, oh, this is an acceptable thing to say to someone.
Mm.
You know, I think as well the whole thing where her manager's trying to protect her from talking to people as though she hasn't got the wherewithal to realise... I mean, the guy is very sketchy, who comes along with the shirt open down to his trousers, and he's like, oh, no, don't talk to him. And I think they're trying to intimate he might be a drug dealer or something like that, or like just a bit of a pervy sex fiend.
With his shirt down to his
but face. That she needed protecting by a man that she wouldn't have the wherewithal. And actually a lot of the story of the issue actually is about the fact that she's better than any man.
Yeah.
You know, a man can try and use her just as a piece of meat. This character, Bob Benson, was going to kill her to get publicity. Just saw her as a piece of meat, a pretty young girl that would be on the front cover of the paper. So actually the story is about, oh, she's got agency over the man.
Yeah, so do you think
that's... within it, she hasn't.
But you need, if that's going to be the takeaway point, you need to show that people think that she doesn't have agency. So I guess the argument
I can see what you're saying, that
yeah,
they're showing that nobody thinks She's as strong as the men, and actually she's better than the men. That's the story.
Yeah.
But it feels more to me like just something that wasn't even thought about.
Okay.
That it feels to me like that kind of 1980s male feminist. And I think male feminists make errors now.
In the same way as
white anti-racists make errors.
If you were to put... if that was the point... Then how else are you going to show that actually people have underrated her as a person, as a woman?
Well, I mean, you can show that just by Bob Benson talking to her. She doesn't need other men to stop her talking to men. To me, that scene felt like just a paternalistic attitude that wasn't deliberately chosen. It was just this idea that women need protecting from men.
Yeah, you can see that in lots of...
And I think that comes from attitudes that weren't questioned by the writer and the artist.
Yeah, okay. I can see that in lots of... in lots of 80s, 90s films.
Yeah, and I think it's just when this... women's
taken away.
This kind of just presumption that men are scum and women need protecting from them.
Yeah.
And the fact that this man is scum and she actually saves herself.
Yeah.
I don't think that's why that scene's like that. I just think there's this... I think this is just something that's accidentally come through in the story.
Mm.
And the men haven't noticed because it's being made entirely by men.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone who works on this comic is a man.
Mm. Yeah.
You know. Even down to, you know, quite often letterers or colourists are women. Okay. But no, this is men all the way.
Okay.
Which is interesting when it was one of the very few Marvel comics that starred a woman was being written, drawn, you know, lettered, coloured, edited by men.
Mm, very much so.
And I think it is an oversight. I don't think it's a deliberate thing. But maybe I'm wrong.
Okay.
And I mean, the other thing, I had three things that I wanted to take points off for. Okay. So the wear something sexy, the kind of... she needs protecting kind of thing as just a base thing. And that is quite common throughout the whole Dazzler series.
Mm.
There's always men, like, trying to protect her. I just think the character of Roman Nekabar, so this film producer that they've got, and this is not his first appearance, and obviously I've read his first appearance.
And
it starts with him being, like, a fat, bald, middle-aged man, and then... they do this whole scene where he puts on a corset and he makes himself look thin and he looks young and glamorous, and then he goes and he kind of seduces her into letting him be the agent.
Mm.
And it's just... I think the character is creepy.
Mm.
And I think his relationship with Dazzler, and in part because of where it goes with Dazzler the movie as a later comic that exists. And, you know, people are on record as... like, I've listened to numerous podcasts about Dazzler the movie, actually. It's one of those seminal books that's really important in Marvel history because it's about the anti-mutant hysteria really getting out of control.
Mm.
Which obviously fed into that Uncanny X-Men we read in our last episode of the podcast. Because this is before then. But Dazzler the movie is basically considered one of the most sexist comic books that Marvel ever released.
Right.
You know, far more sexy than things like Millie the Model in the 50s. You know, it really is. It treats her as a piece of meat and an idiot.
Mm.
You know, and she gets sexually harassed by people and then she has a relationship with them. And it's presented as that being her taking power. And it's like, well, no, having a relationship with someone who harassed you is not powerful. And Roman's a big part of that. And I think that whole storyline gives this... mm. The fact that he's in this story makes it slightly unpalatable to me.
Mm.
So I took off 3 points. And you took off...
3 points.
You said 3 as well. So yours was more of a feeling. Whereas mine was, I have 3 specific things I don't like. But yeah,
there were a few other things, which I can't remember now, that I thought, and that's not very good. But that one where when she was being manhandled
out was aware, so you know where they were on the phone, and yeah, a few other things, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But that doesn't take it away from being...
Oh, it's a very good comic. We just took points off for inappropriate things. Yeah. And unfortunately, a comic can't be created in an era other than when it was created.
No.
I think we all know that these kind of blind spots to do with, you know, in this case, sexism, you know, racism, homophobia, and transphobia, more that happen in culture, you notice them more in hindsight. We should have noticed them at the time.
Yeah.
We should have noticed. Well, not me, because I was like 9.
And I was 8.
And had nothing to do with it.
But, yeah.
But somebody working at Marvel should have noticed that was sexist.
Things that we read now.
In 1983. Yeah.
Things we'll read now, you wonder if they'll...
I'm sure there's things that are completely acceptable now that in 5 or 10 years we'll be like, I can't believe we ever...
That was nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this comic was. Yeah, definitely. Oh, God, I feel old. That means the Thriller video's 40 years old, nearly. Next year, good Lord.
Oh. That is an I remember.
And suddenly I feel old and tired.
Do you remember the first time you saw?
I remember, yeah, the first time I saw it was on Top of the Pops.
Okay.
And they only showed the shortened version. We didn't have MTV.
Okay.
And we weren't close friends with anyone who had MTV. Okay. That was, you had to be pretty wealthy to have MTV in the UK.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Okay.
Because I think you needed satellite television.
Yeah.
Whereas America already had cable, and whereas for us, I think cable comes after satellite more so.
Yeah.
In the UK, it's a different, you know, the kind of costings of it and getting things. Because I think MTV at that point was a free channel.
Oh, was it?
But you had to have...
The satellite
to get it. Okay. And lots of people couldn't afford the satellite, and satellite was more expensive then, and, you know, much more expensive than it is now.
So I think comparatively. So we used to live in a shared house in Finsbury Park. Lovely. Nothing to you guys.
A lot of our listeners are in the UK, so they might know Finsbury Park.
It was not very
nice. They know North London.
It was not very nice. They had to block off a road because of the street corners. The prostitutes, even. I should call it. And anyway, so the neighbours were an Afro-Caribbean family. The girl, whose name was Sasha, she was very nice. I think she was a few years older than I was. And they actually invited me round.
Oh, for the premiere.
So that we could watch, so that I could watch it on their television. Sort of like, and it was...
And it would make sense. You know, I know within, like, my schooling and stuff, people who had family abroad were more likely to have satellite television, because you could link to TV from other countries back then.
Yeah.
It was the only way you could. You know, I know there were a couple of people I was at school with who had family in, like, the Netherlands. Apparently you could pick up, like, Dutch television. Then you could. Yeah. I know it's slightly different now. Mm. You know, the way that we all get television, it's changed. We've got the internet. You can get everything. I suppose it makes sense, maybe, if they did have... they were from a diaspora, that they would be more likely to have the satellite television to link to things. And obviously,
and I can't remember very much about them. I don't I'd have to ask my mother what they did for a living. It was the first time I'd been in, like, a traditional kind of Afro-Caribbean
house. The first video I remember seeing, sorry, this is completely different.
They had, like, sort of, like, plastic flowers and that sort of thing, which is very traditional in Afro-Caribbean families and African families.
Is it?
Yeah, that's why the pound shops up the road sell brightly coloured flowers.
Okay, I thought it was just because people like plastic flowers.
No, apparently it's a thing.
I remember my neighbour... had got, how much later? Oh, it's quite a bit later. My neighbour had MTV by the time Nothing Can Stop Us Now by Starship was released from the film Mannequin. And I remember going round her house and watching where she'd recorded it off the television. so we could watch the whole video, because it was a long song and they never played the whole video on Delhi. Isn't that terrible? We're now into our music video things. Maybe we should discuss instead.
Yes.
Actually, let's finish our scoring. So we're on 28 out of 40 overall, because we've had to take 6 points off mm-hmm. for the things that were wrong with it.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty... The score is kind of middling for our scoring mm-hmm. comics.
Mm.
But actually, it's quite a fun comic. You just have to have the content warning that it is quite sexist in places, I think.
Mm. Yes.
And it's going to work better if you remember, if you've watched the Michael Jackson Thriller video.
Yes.
Now, what I was going to ask there that I nearly moved on to.
Yes.
We'll mention it briefly. Is when do you remember first celebrating Halloween in any big way? Because Halloween is not as much of a thing in the UK as it is in America, obviously.
Trick or treat? No, I don't think.
I will be honest with you, I have never been trick-or-treating.
We wouldn't... I don't think I would have been a big fan of trick-or-treating, because for you guys, I'm physically disabled and I used to walk as a child, but it was quite difficult, so Mum wouldn't have wanted to drag me around people's front doors.
I mean, I remember my mum saying, and this is very... particular type of working class mm-hmm. but Mum's thing was, we are not the kind of people who go and beg. That was my mum's attitude.
Okay.
And I think she also had a bit of that kind of cultural superiority of it's American and we're not Americans, we're English.
Yeah, I think that would
we're not really English, we're half Irish, half that Welsh would and have... stuff, but you know, that is a big, I think there's a certain type of English person who doesn't like Halloween because it's American.
Yeah.
Or they consider it America.
Like my parents would have, probably.
Yeah, I can imagine that with your parents. I mean, I remember at school we would do things like apple bobbing and we would talk about it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I went to Catholic schools, which you didn't.
No.
And we would definitely talk about All Hallows Eve, mm-hmm. which is what Halloween comes from, yeah. and then All Saints Day.
Yeah.
You know, and we were talking the other day about when I was at university, I went to a university called Trinity and All Saints. Mm-hmm. So All Saints Day was a big celebration day. We had no lectures. Mm-hmm. They would do special masses, coming in at the Catholic College, and everybody were in the bar for the day. It's quite nice to spend a day in the bar in November, you know, first November. Yeah. So, you know, it was more of like a religious and a slightly kind of, but also slightly British pagan. It was very small.
Yeah.
Wasn't so much about sweets and chocolate or costumes.
Sure.
That was something I saw in America. It was something on films and telly. It wasn't real.
Mm.
In comics. It wasn't something that happened. Mm. And I don't remember any of our neighbours knocking on our house at Halloween. But I don't know if that's just because my mum made it so clear to everyone that she wouldn't go begging and she wasn't going to give anything to anyone who'd go begging. I can imagine... Knowing my mother, I can imagine her clearly telling the neighbours, if they were planning on taking their children trick-or-treating, not to knock at our house, because they would get nothing.
Your mum is very nice. You make her sound...
My mum is absolutely lovely. She's a wonderful person. But she has certain... There's certain things for her are really important. And it was really important to her. We were quite poor. And it was very important to her that we didn't seem poor.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
So I think the whole, you know, don't go begging.
Yeah.
That was a real...
I think people did. Yeah, I think, no, we had trick-or-treaters in another house that we lived in. I think we had kids coming round.
But, I mean, you lived in London, so it's a more cosmopolitan place. You know, people are more likely to have picked things up from, you know, I was in a small town outside.
Yeah.
Quite a way outside of London. It's a different atmosphere.
We wouldn't have.
Yeah. And possibly if I'd been more rural, I'd have had more of like the traditional, there'd have been even more of the apple bobbing and the fires and the kind of, I mean, we did do like the food, gingerbread, that kind of stuff, toffee apples. But for us, it was much more about bonfire night, which is like five days later.
Yeah, Halloween.
To Halloween, you know, I think that could be a real...
Guy Fawkes night.
Yeah, Guy Fawkes night, bonfire night, 5th of November. So that's a bit of a discussion of Halloween.
Which Americans probably don't do Halloween.
Well, Americans definitely don't do the 5th of November.
Remember.
5th of November is us remembering the king almost being defeated. Americans already have a date to remember the king being defeated.
They do.
Which you know all about from Hamilton.
We do. I would sing Hamilton.
Yes, let's not.
But let's not.
So, yes, they celebrate it on the 4th of July.
They do.
They didn't actually... Nobody tried to kill the king, though. They just told him to piss off.
Yes.
Which, you know, but the current king. It's very confusing having a king.
But he'll be back.
Well, the king? I don't think he'll be back that much. He's quite an old man. He doesn't look healthy.
That was a Hamilton reference.
Yes, I know. I got it. And I was joking.
No.
It's this thing what people do sometimes.
Is it? Okay.
Yes. So on that bombshell.
Aaron Burr.
So on that bombshell, Halloween Spooktacular is over. And a comic that we chose, Dazzler 33. Should I love this comic?
Yeah.
I think it's a yes. I think it's a yes overall.
It was fun.
Just some content warnings for people who might,
fun,
you know, get really offended by sexism.
Fun.
And, you know, don't read it if you are John Landis. No, you might be offended.
He probably does know. I mean, if you Google it, it's probably John Landis, Dazzler.
Well, I very much doubt he would read that. But then he probably was into comics at some point. It would go...
He knows about it.
Yeah,
he'd
possibly.
He's probably got his lawyers on it. And thinking, no, don't bother.
No. I don't think it was important enough to get your... I don't think Marvel in the 1980s was big enough for people to get their lawyers on it.
Okay.
I genuinely don't. I think it was kind of an independent... It was owned... At this point, it's still owned by Cadence, I think they were called. Which was kind of... it was a weird company that owned lots of odd things. It wasn't owned by a media conglomerate, so it wasn't a risk. Anyway, on that bombshell, which I've said already 5 times, let's go. I like to try and keep this under an hour, and we've just gone over. So thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget, if you want to comment, if you want to tell us your backstory of Halloween or your backstory of MTV, because we've got covered both. You can go to our blog post. No. You can go to shouldiloveThis.blogspot.com and leave a comment on the post about the episode. Anyway, see you all soon. Next time we'll be back with another Should I Love This Era, looking at another one of the special 25th anniversary comics. This time it's going to be a reprint. So it was a reprint even in 1986. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Hope to see you all soon, or hope you'll hear us soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.